Okay, hello, it's Greg Kelly, and it is a weekend in late August 2021. You and I have seen those horrible pictures from Afghanistan, the chaos, those people running next to the plane. What a catastrophe. It is almost unthinkable that we would get into this situation again and utterly avoidable. Look, I said for a year and a half, 2 years, on my program here, but primarily on the TV show, I highlighted Joe Biden's deficiencies, his deficiencies of character, his deficiencies in competence and judgment, and I thought they were glaring. And I was so incredibly stumped that no one else, hardly anyone else in all of media, chose to explore these issues. Everyone else seemed to have Trump derangement syndrome, exaggerating his deficiencies, and he has some, but exaggerating them beyond all recognition, dismissing his vast qualities and talents, and focusing solely on Donald Trump and giving Joe Biden a huge pass, not pressure testing a candidate. And that's what it's supposed to be about. A political campaign. Most political journalism is very superficial and silly. They justify it, though, by saying, well, sure, it may be horse race, it may be scandal of the second, but we have to apply that pressure. They have to get by us so we know they'll be able to perform on the job. It's a test. Well, they never tested Joe Biden. They went right along with the COVID excuse. COVID, while a real thing, totally shielded Joe Biden, and the media should not have stood for that. Yet they did. They were co-conspirators in a way. And now we are seeing the disastrous results. The media are as much to blame for what's happening in Afghanistan as is Joe Biden, in my opinion. This all could have been avoided had they not covered for him. I think that his defects should have been highlighted, and they weren't. And what a shame. I don't know what's going to happen next. In the meantime, I am embarking yet again on a program of personal improvement. I will tell you about it once I start making progress. Today was day one, so I really feel kind of silly telling you about what I did. I think I have to get at least, I don't know, how many days do I have to get under my belt till I know that this is I know it's going to be a real thing. I'm telling myself it's going to be a real thing. I have no choice. So I think maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month. Then I'll have some real momentum. Then I'll have some, I don't want to start again from scratch. This is it. I'll tell you about it next time. Anyway, today my guest is Jeanine Turner. Jeanine Turner, America fell in love with her on that Northern Exposure show. She was on that, for 5 seasons as Maggie O'Connell, the pilot, with the short hair. Great actress, very beautiful. She's involved in so many things, a couple of things. Number one, she's got this Hallmark movie coming up. It's called Taking the Reins. It comes out on September 25th at 9 o'clock. She has a Broadway project also in the works. You can check out her podcast, God on the Go, which we'll talk about. And she's also very civically minded. She has a nonprofit called Constituting America. It is totally nonpartisan, and it educates and informs the public about the U.S. Constitution. Who could argue with that? It's such a pure, beautiful project that she's involved in. I really first noticed her, though, when I went to go see the movie Cliffhanger. I was in San Diego. It was in the early 90s, and there was something about it that made total sense to me. She was in that movie with Sylvester Stallone, and I knew she was a TV star, but she pops up in this movie. I'm like, aha, of course, it makes sense. Hit show? Of course she would be in a movie like this. And gosh, so healthy, so in such great shape, and so clean and pure. And I think that she is still those things. It's quite an amazing person. I was very impressed with her, and I think you'll like her. Jeanine Turner, here is our conversation. Have you ever thought about serving the public in political office? It seems like you could really help this country in a lot of different ways. You already are, but on a bigger scale. Is it something you've ever considered, or has anybody ever suggested it to you?
Hi, by the way. It's great to be on the show.
Sorry.
And I'm a huge fan of yours, and thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you.
You never rest. You're just a machine. But yes, well, you know, okay, look, my father was a West Pointer. And I've been told by a friend I'm supposed to say United States Military Academy at West Point. But of course, everybody just says West Pointer. In a class, you know, 54 to 57. So it was a class of 57. And so I was raised with that sort of duty to country. He back then it was Air Force Army. And he chose Air Force because the Air Force Academy wasn't completed yet. And was one of the first to fly twice the speed of sound. And was part of the Strategic Air Command. And had a mission to Russia, which if he had to go, would never return. And there was just, I was raised with that sort of mentality. And even though he got out of the service when I was pretty young, but he was always a pilot and always very honest and very dedicated to country and principles. And I remember looking up at him when I was 8 years old. And we, you know, my dad was one of those silent military types. So it's not like we ever had political discussions around the table. That just didn't happen. But for some reason, I think it's because I'm related to George Washington, which I can tell you about in a minute, but I must have an angel, a founding father angel on my shoulder. But I asked him, Dad, I was 8 years old, if our founding fathers were to come back today, what would they be most disappointed about? Which, you know, what 8-year old asked that question? So, of course, you want to know what he said?
What?
Taxes.
Great answer.
16th Amendment. But anyway, he didn't say that. He just said taxes. But I remember that moment, which is also so weird. Yes, I have thought about it. I have definitely thought about it. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, I think life is sort of filled with chapters. And my first chapter was my childhood in Texas, but I was also modeling in New York City at the age of 15. So my professional chapter was until Northern Exposure wrapped in cliffhanger to 1995, I guess. And then my daughter was born in 1997. So then it was motherhood chapter. And then during that time, I was, you know, pretty active with my foundation and politically. And then now I feel like I'm sort of back in my artistic chapter because I'm acting again. I've written this amazing Broadway musical that will be definitely inspirational on a faith level, but will be very inspirational on a political level as well. So I think I'm serving my country still with this particular Broadway musical. And so then, you know, I guess I'm 58. So I joke that I'll be on Broadway at 60. My Broadway debut will be at 60. So I don't know, maybe there's a chapter there, maybe at 65 or something. There's a chapter where I will do that. It's funny because like people used to think women, oh, you're too old to go into politics at 65 as a woman. But then again, men do it all the time. However, I don't really know that, I think my daughter is going to be the better candidate for that, you know, to run for office. I think perhaps running for office will be channeled through me to my daughter. I just don't know. It's so ruthless and they attack you so immensely. And I just don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. It may not even be worth it. It is such a brutal life, but two things actually. When you mentioned chapters, when you were living your life, as you look back now, you can see, okay, this was a chapter and this was a phase. Did you recognize at the time that, okay, I'm actually moving into this next chapter and I will focus on this for the next 3 to 5 years? Or is it just like looking back now, yes, it looks that way. Did you recognize at the time that you were kind of closing one door temporarily and opening another and then you're going to go back to that door? Or is it just like now it all makes sense?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that when Northern Exposure was a success and was picked up for 50 episodes at once is when I finally thought, oh, okay, I did it. You know, I was nominated for Golden Globes and Emmy and all that. And I thought, okay, I did it, at least to this juncture. And I was 33 when Northern Exposure wrapped. I was like, wait, okay, now I've been this career woman and who never thought about returning to Texas. But the minute I had my success, I thought, okay, I want a ranch, I want a horse, I want a pickup truck. But yeah, I could go back and own the Texas that I left at essentially age 15. And But when you're an actress, you can't really be in Texas at that point, especially. You had to be in New York or LA. And then I wanted to, you know, to have my family. And then my daughter was born. Family didn't work out the way I wanted, but, you know, my daughter was born. And then I went into that chapter. And I think that I was completely devoted to my daughter. And I've been posting some pictures on Instagram of the two of us when she was young. And the one thing I knew is that, okay, I still worked. I mean, I did Movies of the Weeks and I had a television series. But I wrapped the television series early, Strong Medicine for Lifetime, because my daughter was two and a half. And even though she was with me on set, I was working 14 hours a day straight. And I thought, I don't want to miss these years. You never get these years back. And so I moved back to Texas and really dedicated my life to raising my daughter. I took my daughter to school every single day of her life, except maybe one, you know, sat in the car because, we lived on the ranch, but it was too far from where her school. So a lot of times I would sit in the car or try to work out of my car. I mean, but in the meantime, I was launching a foundation and wrote four books, published books, and, directed a short film. And I it's not like I was not doing things with my life, but I didn't leave Texas, essentially. And my focus was to be with her. And so that was definitely a chapter. I don't know that I really foresaw this third chapter I'm in where, okay, wait a minute. Whoops. Yeah. I was a single mom. She's grown. And what do I do now? It's been a really challenging time in my life because I never wanted to be a single mother. It just happened that way. And I think that when you're in the midst of it, you say, you march along, like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. It's going to work. I'm going to do it. You know, trying to not be where my financial bevy was and try to make all ends meet and work raising her in a way that I felt I wanted her to be raised. But then suddenly they're off, you know, individualizing and finding themselves. And it's a pretty lonely period. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm alone now. Ooh, what do I do now? I've got to go. So that's why I'm back in New York City. So I don't know that I really foresaw this third chapter, but I'm excited to be back in showbiz and have this musical. And, I think life is one big challenge. How do I climb this staircase of enlightenment? How do I not fall into a crater of depression and climb out? And do what God wants me to do and just show up one day after another and try to live my life as God would want it.
Wow. A couple of quick things. Number one, I have never heard anyone call it, as you did accurately, the United States Military Academy at West Point. Even West Pointers just say West Point. And I think I heard that phrase once in like 1988. Have you been there, by the way? Have you been back lately?
I was able to take my daughter when she was in third grade. It was my dad's 50th reunion. It was a 50th reunion. So we all went back, and it was amazing.
I love that place. It's one of my favorite places on earth. It's even though I didn't attend. Let's actually go to the Broadway project right now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Starting something on Broadway in the middle of this situation we have. Broadway is dark, I guess, and is kind of coming back. That has immensely complicated the project, or do you have a handle on it?
Actually, it's worked really well. I have I wrote a book in Holding Her Head High, and that was published by Thomas Nelson, which is now HarperCollins, in I guess 2006, 2007. And then I, based off this book, I wrote the Broadway show in 2019, and then 2020 happened. Polished it in 2020 during the Broadway musical. And then I have a producer, Michael Jenkins, who's won, I don't know, 4 to 7 Tonys, and he loves it. And so I decided to move to New York City to do dance classes and singing classes and get prepared, you know, as I said, a Broadway debut at 59, you know, I'm 58 now, but I'll be 59 by the time it gets on Broadway. And so I found an amazing composer. I wrote the book and the lyrics, and this composer, we do everything via Zoom. She's in Miami. But we have composed 10 out of 18 songs. We have 8 more songs. So we're using this time to finish composing the songs. I'm getting prepared. I'm taking on my, having my voice lessons and prep, polishing the songs. And then the backers reading is going to be in December. So hopefully, by the time January, February, March, I think we want to launch it in March on Broadway. In my circumstance, it'll be perfect timing. For everybody else, I just finished a Hallmark movie, and one of the co-stars is in Moulin Rouge on Broadway. They're actually starting up now. They're going to start back in September. But now we have this crazy Delta variant. So, I don't know anymore. And now in New York City, everybody has to prove their vaccinations, and it's kind of crazy. Though I hear that so many people are getting Delta anyway with two vaccinations and ending up in the hospital. So I don't think that, whatever. I don't know.
The project, well, it's interesting how it's all kind of working out at the same time amid this. But wait, actually, you mentioned, look, vaccinations, you got to prove it. And you're an expert on the Constitution. Does that seem right to you that we would have to, especially in New York and maybe other cities, present proof of a vaccine, of a personal health decision? Do you see it that way?
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting having been in Texas and now in New York City. And it's interesting. I thought when I arrived in New York City that all my friends and anybody I approached in the street, anybody I saw in a store would say, "Did you get vaccinated? Did you get vaccinated? Did you get vaccinated?" And nobody has asked me if I'm vaccinated, which I thought, oh, okay, look at that. People are being pretty cool. But then it's ironic because the friends, when they do talk about it, they think no one wears a mask in Texas. I'm just like, that's not true. There are a lot of people in Texas that wear masks. There are a lot of people in Texas. So it's a stereotypical thing that becomes a political, I don't know, what do you know, problem. And what I believe in a broader sense regarding vaccinations is I love philosophy. I'm a huge Plato fan. I'm reading a book right now about from Plato to Christ. And Plato, I think, even in my mind, correlates with quantum entanglement, but I digress. And I think that there are two aspects to these sort of decisions. One is ethics, and the other is logic. And I think that ethically, you go, okay, yeah, everybody should be protected and everyone should look after everybody, but then there's logic. And what about the people that have enough antibodies, they don't need a shot? Or what about the people who got one and were allergic to it and couldn't get the second? Or what about people who just don't believe in it because it's experimental? I mean, there's a logical aspect that fits into play here that I think gets overlooked by a passion play.
Wow. A passion play.
I think people look at this from a kind of a knee-jerk passion. I think it's happening in politics in general right now in this country, and we've lost all sense of logic and reason. And that's why our founding fathers were amazing, because they were so brilliant, which we still have brilliant people, you know, but they were brilliant, but they were able to debate and they were able to reason and they were able to see the bigger picture and they were able to come together for the good of the country. There has to be ethics, but there also has to be logic.
So if you're now you're probably your father's age when you were 8 years old. And no, he was probably younger than you. Anyway, when you were eight, yeah, you asked your dad that question about what our founding fathers be disappointed by. What do you think now? What do you think they would be most disappointed by?
Wow, that's a big question. I think that they would be really disappointed about George Washington would be very concerned about the political divide. His entire sort of trajectory, I love George Washington. I love them all. I love John Adams. I love all of them. But his entire trajectory was unity. And he realized, as you know, Greg, you know, that during the war as a general, he had all these random, various, different, uniformed, different perspective thinking people coming together from random colonies, which were like countries, to try to fight this war in unity, which is why John Adams wanted the Declaration of Independence, to give people that unity. And his entire focus during the Revolutionary War was unity. If we can't unite as a people, and my gosh, it was so crazy back then, it was like herding cats. And if we can't unite everybody and for a higher purpose, we can't win the war. And then we're doing a study on my Constituting America Constitutional Chats podcast right now about the anti-federalist. But at the convention, why did the Constitution pass when there was so much angst against it? With the anti-federalists and their fear of big government. Why did it pass? Because George Washington was there. And Alexander Hamilton even left the convention early, you know, but George Washington was the president. He sat there the entire time. He never left. He lent it its credibility because he saw, if we can't come together as sort of a United States now and find unity, we're going to dissolve. If we can't find commerce and a way to pay our debts and a military and a united focus, we will falter and we will divide. And if you think about the time, Spain was still in our territory and France was still in our territory and England was still in Canada. You know, it's like we were still surrounded by the enemies. And if we can't come together, which of course we're surrounded by enemies now, they're already here one way or another. if we can't unite, we can't survive. And so I think that George Washington would be most disappointed about the lack of logic in our political system.
Fantastic answer. Makes total sense. I thought you were going to say the swamp, the permanent government, the unelected power base that we now have, which
I think, which founding father would be concerned about that? Perhaps Madison would be concerned about that. Yes.
How did you?
I think all of them would think it's gotten a little bit out of control.
So,
as far as big government is concerned,
you grew up in you were born in Nebraska.
But if we don't have unity, we don't have anything.
Do you really think so? I'm not so sure about.
We have to have differing points of view. We have a program at Constituting America that I created called with Kathy Gillespie, called How to Have a Civil Civic Conversation. And what we do is we take hot topics like climate change, or the border wall, or gun control, and we have the kids just debate it passionately, and then we say, okay, now, and usually, God bless them, there's only three people standing up for one of the topics, you know what I mean, against 27 other kids. But we say, all right, let's now read an article, and I'm going to have you read an article on both points of view, and when you read this article, I want you to find three things where you can agree, and or that you didn't even know about because you've just been listening to the echo chamber. And so, yes, and then the kids at the end find three things they agree with the opposite side. They find that 5% where they can have common ground, and they learn how to write a bill. So I'm not saying that we all need to think the same at all, because it's that differing perspectives of left and right that when we come together to find some way to move our country forward, that's what keeps tyranny from happening. If we all thought the same, we'd be under tyranny. So I'm not saying we all have to think the same, but I think we do need to find common ground and learn to just be reasonable people.
You know, I would have said that a year ago, maybe, but now it's like you have the left and they're questioning the fundamental underpinnings of America. You know, this is a white supremacist country, and it's fundamentally flawed, and that's hard to find common ground with. For a lot of us. And do you know what I mean? It's just, and I think Madison was the one who said, you have to be basically a believer in God for all of this stuff to work. Didn't some of the founding fathers say that? This is basically based on Judeo-Christian values, although I don't think they said Judeo-Christian values at the time. And it relies on God-fearing people for all of this to kind of come together. It doesn't. If half the electorate is sympathetic to socialism and borderline atheistic values, it won't work.
I'll take it back to Plato, and what Plato, Socrates came out of this out of the era with the sophist. Is that how you pronounce her name? Sophist. I think it's S-O. Anyway, they
you notice I got really quiet there. I don't know. I've heard of sophistry. I think it's sophist.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, you know, I don't know. I self-teach myself, so I don't have a professor studying in front of me. But they before Socrates, the way of philosophy was we're going to win at any level, and we're just right, and it's about money and power, and we're going to win. And so Socrates hated that because he's like, wait a minute, where's your reason? Where's your sense of justice? And so Socrates and Plato and then Aristotle is all about, especially Plato, where is the goodness? Where is the responsibility for justice and living your life the right way? And he talked about forms and that we on earth are becoming, but we're trying to be like the being. And it echoes very much our sense of Judeo-Christianity, and that we're just trying to replicate what we know is up in with God, and we need to be good, honest, just people. And I think that we're kind of in that struggle right now. Is it going to be just to win for winning's sake, or are we going to really look at this picture from a standpoint where we can look for the higher good? And I think that honestly, in my life, and I'll just speak for my life, I've learned that I just need to try to stair step up to higher good, higher good, higher good, and to try to, and I think that's what we should be focused on in this country.
When you were in New York as a teenager modeling and later in Hollywood, You were academically oriented back then, and I'm wondering, and listening to you now, did you find yourself not fitting in because of your curiosity about things not related to the arts, or did you?
A little bit. Yeah, that's interesting because now I straddle. I feel like I have two sides. I have this sense of myself that's an artist. I'm definitely an artist. I sing, I dance, I write, I create, I write poetry and plays and books. And I love to be on stage and I love to sing and dance. So it definitely exists. But then I have this other side, which is very just focused on, I mean, all I want to do is soak things up intellectually. All I do is watch, you know, documentaries and I want to learn and grow, primarily focused in this enlightenment phase, you know, my God on the Go podcast and things of that nature. But I'm very, very, very curious. And so, yeah, I mean, I think actors have a good heart, and I think that they're great humanitarians, and I think that they're seekers. But, you know, Plato didn't like artists. He thought they were the lowest of the low because we just imitate. We're just pretending. We don't really seek true truths. And so in his ladder, the artists and imitators were on the very, very bottom. But nevertheless, I think Plato might not be too upset with me because there's another half of me that's definitely a seeker that's trying to find justice and do good and to become like the being in heaven. And I am a Christian, so I'm not trying to be really weird. But Plato was really saying at the time, what Christianity says, though we're a country of all religions, but I happen to be a Christian, so I can only speak to that.
So am I, by the way. When you're modeling, let me just ask you this about the modeling business. You're with your mom, I believe. You're 15, 16, 17. She was living with you in New York, right?
Yes, I was modeling from the age of 3 and dancing in Texas. And then at 15, they alternatively take credit for this, but either my mother or my father, probably both, but my mother wanted me to go into the Ford. But back then it was Ford and Wilhelmina were the two top agencies in New York City. And so I wasn't really tall enough, but I was only 15. And so I got in the door to go in and meet with Wilhelmina herself, Wilhelmina Cooper, this beautiful woman. And I walked into her office and she said, look left, look right, and all this kind of stuff, looking at my face. And she said, when can you be here? And I said, I'll be here in a month. And so I picked up and of course my mother was like, what? I thought this would be kind of fun and maybe a summer thing. My mother had never left the state of Texas in her life, you know, born in 1934. And so she said, my dad looked at me and said, okay, you can go, but you're going to pay for your own private school and your own apartment. When you run out of money, you're coming home. So from the age of 15, I was independent, but my mother was with me when I was up here from the age of 15.
Which was important. I mean, look, I've heard this, modeling, it can be, strange things happen with these photographers. It's not always a wholesome business. And having your mother there was I guess very important, right? I mean, that she protected you.
Yeah, she did. And I attended professional children's school, which I loved, because talk about intellectually curious. You know, suddenly I went from my little small town Texas school, which was great. I loved it there. I was a cheerleader and all that. But now suddenly I'm in the school where they're teaching me like college level, lectures and things of that nature about medieval times. And I don't know, I loved it. But yeah, my mom was with me. She didn't always go up with me to the actual, she would wait downstairs, but yeah, my mom was with me, God bless her. But I think the biggest thing for me was surviving being chased by Great Danes down staircases or going up the elevators where I was stuck all the time in these elevators going to these hole in the wall places. I mean, it's just not glamorous. They call in their 5 interviews a day and they send you all over the city. In whatever kind of weather to go in and meet with I don't know how they do it now, but they had to meet with these photographers and they don't have any money. So you're in these really grungy, horrible places. It was a challenge. Getting stuck in the elevators was the worst part.
And
robbed. We were robbed all the time. We're talking 1970s.
Yeah.
That was taken out of our hands and purses stolen. It was craziness.
Well, welcome back to the past. New York is really declining.
Come full circle.
Yeah. So and then the acting starts. You dabble in it, or what's the best way to describe? I'm saying from your teenage years to your mid 20s. How what kind of relationship do you have with acting?
Well, I was a dancer and singer first, and then and model, and acting was just sort of the natural next step. I was cast to play Charlene Tilton's friend in Dallas, because Dallas filmed there, and that's when Dallas was the biggest show ever in the whole wide world. And it was this, I was cast in the episode right after JR was shot. I don't know, you may not remember this, but
sure,
who shot JR
is the biggest deal in the world.
It was. And so I was in the episode that the first episode the next season, which was one of the highest rating forever. And that producer said, you should go to Hollywood. And then at the same time, I was screen tested by the fantastic Franco Zeffirelli. That's a long, really cool story about how I just wouldn't give up in meeting him. They said no to me in Texas. They said no to me in LA. And finally, I went to New York and met Franco Zeffirelli in New York. And I became his pick for Endless Love. But the studio wanted Brooke Shields. I ended up not doing it. I wouldn't do the nudity and all that. But nevertheless, it's a great story. So I was getting sort of a lot of, as my mother said, encouragement. So I packed up my Buick Regal and drove out to Hollywood at the age of 17. Graduated from the high school a year early. I always wanted to go to college, but my dad was like, you're already making a lot of money. Why would you go to college? So my intellectual side has been just sort of self-taught.
And with that money you were making, were you smart with it? I mean, were you disciplined with it? How did you manage that?
Yeah, I think I was disciplined with it. I mean, I booked a late night soap opera at the age of 18. At the age of 19, I was on General Hospital starring with Demi Moore. She and I were sisters. And so the money was good. But the problem that I found, and that's what my dad said, you know, no way, you're already making, you know, about as much money as he was making. So it was like, why would you go to college? Because to them, college was about getting a job. He's like, I'm not going to pay for you to go to college, just, you know, sit around and be an intellectual. I'm like, well, all right. But the biggest challenge for me was the way women were treated in the 70s and the 80s. And I was engaged to Alec Baldwin at the time, and I was going to get married. We had the dress, the invitations and everything. But I was watching how he was getting all these really cool auditions. And I was constantly just getting TNA auditions, and I was always, you know, kidnapped, or it was supposed to be an airhead or stupid, and that wasn't who I was, and it wasn't the kind of career I wanted. So I moved to New York City at the age of 23 I said, if I can't respect myself, I'm not going to do this or respect this business. Cut my hair and found a method acting, Lee Strasberg method acting coach, and really delved into craft and auditioned here in New York City.
So, by the way, the roles aren't what the men are getting. You know, they're these roles where you play the victim, or they want you to play the victim. What about behind the scenes? I mean, now that Me Too has happened and the Harvey thing, and we hear all these terrible stories about casting and the casting couch and all that stuff. Something tells me that they didn't mess with you, but did you see any of that? Did you hear about it happening?
I mean, that definitely happened to me. Definitely. Of course. I had executives want to, they would always seem to give you, you know, I was 17. They would always want to give you kissing scenes and make you go in and you'd have to kiss a guy for an audition. Or one time the executive wanted me to sit on the couch and kiss him for the audition. And I was like, no, thank you. I'm leaving. I call my agent. You know, I had producers, you know, yeah. It happened. It wasn't prevalent, but it happened. I think the thing that was more detrimental for me was auditions where I had to wear a bikini. And I remember I was sitting there and this man was smoking a cigar and he asked me to do a 360. And so I did a 360 and he took a puff off his cigar. I was like, if you just lost 5 pounds.
Oh.
So the thing that I hated the most was being objectified, and it was everybody just saw what they wanted to see through their perfect 10, you know, wanting to be this perfect beauty. And I felt that I was much deeper and had much more to give than that. And toward the end, when I was 27, before I booked Northern Exposure, was saying no to all those parts and hoping of getting really respectable parts. And that's when I had $8 left. And it's an amazing story of survival and not giving up before the miracle. And because I was ready to just a very deep, dark, black hole in my life. And I showed up for that one last audition, which was Northern Exposure. And God is great, because what was Northern Exposure? The first Maggie O'Connell, the first really strong woman on television. It was, and my daughter can't even understand how women just weren't given these roles. And so suddenly I played a woman who wore parkas and chopped her own wood and flew her own plane and fixed her own plumbing and was completely independent. And it was just a real, real gift, that show.
So cool. And I remember where I was and when it was a hit and how intrigued we were with you. I was in flight school at the time, by the way.
And, thanks for serving the country. I meant to say that earlier. Thank you.
No, but listen, so the Me Too movement for I am of two minds. Some of it, I think, has gone way too far and has been over the top ridiculous. However, I do think a major correction was in order. And this has undoubtedly cleaned up a lot of things that were happening that shouldn't have been happening, especially in entertainment. How do you feel about Me Too and where we are right now?
Probably how I really feel, I won't say. Okay. But I think that, I think, yes, a correction was needed. I think that it's good that there's a higher level of enlightenment and awareness on this issue. I think it's fantastic that more women are being hired. And in, as you know, I just finished a movie of the week. The director was a woman. And I think that, you know, there was this thing about in Hollywood, if I were to take a script to a producer and say, hey, I want to direct this. And I've had this happen even recently, they'll look at me and say, I literally had one man say to me, are there all women on the team? I mean, you know what I mean? Really? But if a young man goes in, and says, I want to direct this, then the man's, you know, oh, sure, go direct it. It's just, you know, it's just this thing we have to, you know, continually try, you know, to stair step and get to a higher level. I don't know what to say about the Me Too movement. It's good that they're, I mean, what I really want to say, I shouldn't say, I'm not going to say. And so I'm just going to
say.
Yeah,
let's leave it at that.
It's a self-correction that it's a, yeah, what I really want to say.
Hey, if I said everything I wanted to say, I would be in jail. I don't know. I mean,
it's a self-correction that needed to happen, and it's good that's happened.
When I was in the military, they had a scandal that, like, literally the month I joined the military, there was something called the Tailhook scandal. You may have heard about it. It was in Las Vegas, and it was a convention. And I wasn't there, but it was a bunch of naval aviators, and they got way out of hand, and women were groped and all kinds of things, other female aviators. And it was a national scandal, and they had us undergo, throughout the military, especially the Marine Corps, the Navy, this, like, state-of-the-art sexual harassment awareness training. I mean, it was very, very good. And for a long time, the military was, like, in a strange way, one of the wokest organizations you could find when it came to those matters, although things tend to be forgotten and overwritten. But while I was in the military, it was very much top of mind. And I think we came up with a great set of rules and guidelines. And hey, if I could, if you don't mind, you mentioned method acting and Lee Strasberg. And can you just do me a favor? What is method acting? Or what is the method?
Oh, yeah. And just to close the chapter, we're into chapters today, of what we were just talking about. I like to look at life, and I like to look at civilization, and I like to look at America and say, are we stair-stepping up in the right direction? And if you look at civilization, it's interesting. You know, look at how we continue to improve, and we continue to go in the right direction. And I think that focusing on our innate ability to want to be the best and to continue to try to rise and to combine ethics with logic. I think if you looked back and we shouldn't look back, it's like expecting a 3-year-old to understand what a 27-year-old understands, you know, or a 56-year-old, the 3-year-old doesn't understand. We project where we are now onto history, and it's really hard to do that.
Well, with that in mind, I think then I'll just run this by you. I think we're taking massive steps backward, or at best we plateaued as a society, as a planet. In so many ways, I see degradation. Yeah, we just agreed about Me Too. Correction had to happen, but at the coarsening of everything else, I mean, the access to, just take the pornography. I mean, there was a time where, you know, certain men went two towns over to get it. And now every kid has access to everything. This is not good for us.
This instant gratification and social media, it fits in a little bit to what I believe with acting. You know, with acting, it's becoming, the shots in acting are becoming very fast, if you notice. As you said, let's just look at Downton Abbey. Everybody loved Downton Abbey. When Downton Abbey started, the scenes would be long. They'd linger on people's faces. By the time Downton Abbey was finished, the scenes were about 15 seconds. You know, sometimes it'd be this 30-second scene, and everybody would talk really fast. And so everything's fast, 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 fast. If you go back and watch the AFI's 100 Greatest Movies, when you go back and look at that, watch those classics, they lingered on people's faces, and they took their time. And it was just – and there's a wonderful new show called The Restaurant. It's a Swedish.
Oh, I've seen it. Absolutely love it.
Wasn't it great?
Fantastic. It's funny that you mentioned that. Yeah,
and the acting was fantastic. But what they did from a cinematic standpoint is they lingered on people's faces. They would let the actors think and let them breathe, and you could see the churning of emotions. And we've forgotten how to do that now as a society, the way it moves so quickly. And to talk about what is method acting.
Well, okay. Let me just ask you about The Restaurant for a second. Yeah. I got to one thing that I really loved about it is as I was watching it,
the restaurant?
Yeah, and I'm sure you noticed this. I thought, my goodness gracious, you know what would help this person, especially, I can't remember his name, the heavier one who was conflicted sexually and he was an alcoholic.
Right.
If this guy found God, you know, the God is the answer to so many problems here, and that he ultimately found that solution, and they presented it not in the way Christians are usually presented, you know, Bible-thumping weirdos in entertainment. Mm-hmm. It was like a very sensitive portrayal, and I was blown away by it. I was just blown away by it.
Yeah, I was too. They took chances in every area, and they really focused on love. And I think that was the love and the arc of the family. Wonderful arcs. It's just a great show. I encourage everyone to watch it. Wonderful arcs.
Can
wonderful
I run arcs. One more movie by you? Planet of the Apes. It's just to what you're saying about Downton Abbey, if I could. Planet of the Apes is my favorite movie. I grew up with it as a kid, 7 years old. It was on. And it makes sense now, just what you said. Do you realize it takes 20 minutes for the apes to show up in that movie? I mean, they build slowly, and there's philosophizing happening as Charlton Heston is like musing to himself. Then I saw the new Planet of the Apes movie. And the very first scene, there's an ape yelling at you, like just like there. It's all in your face. It's all that instant.
Fast.
Yeah, which I don't like, and I don't think is. But who knows? You got to adapt. So
well, I still love big wide masters, and for things to evolve and take their time. I think The Restaurant is a great example of that. Everyone should check it out.
What is this method?
So what is method acting? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, method acting freaks a lot of people out because they think, you know, an actor that's going to be over the top. So I've learned to say sensory, but I still think it's the best. And that's what Marilyn Monroe and Robert De Niro and Jessica Lange and Paul Newman, Dustin Hoffman, all of them were method actors. And essentially what it is making a series of, well, my acting coach, Marsha Hoffert, was fantastic, and she's still my friend all these years later, and I've seen her now that I'm back in New York City, but it was just a set of tools and, you know, relaxation, how key relaxation is, which I think I'm also doing, you know, a meditation now with this great app called Headspace. I really, really like it. It's just meditation and worrying about how to deal with anxiety and all this. We have totally forgotten how to cope in this country. Of course, faith as well, but, you know, just relaxation and then your instrument, And the choices that you make. So you make very specific choices, but you rely on your senses. So it's not just in your head. It's not cerebral acting. It's sensory acting. So I don't know if you've ever gone into your grandmother's cabinet and you open the cabinet and it smells like a certain smell of my grandmother's cabinet had this really cool, unique sort of musky, cinnamony sort of smell. I've never been able to replicate it, but I loved it. It made me feel safe. So if I ever want to feel like my environment's safe, I'll start trying to actually smell that cabinet again. And so you just make very when I open the cabinet, very specific choices. Who is the person I'm talking to? And let me see their hair, and let me try to actually. So it's just a sensorial type of acting, and I really still believe it's the best, because what it's going to do is it's the hardest, because you're triggering really deep things. If it's a deep scene or a very traumatic scene, you have to go back and find those things of trauma in your life and click into it. So it's, but it brings, I believe, the truest, most genuine sorts of emotions.
And so is it kind of a way to not act, in a way? I mean, like, not pretend. You want to really feel something instead of simulating it.
Right. And it creates what that does is bring Plato would like it, because it's more of a genuine, it's not as much of an imitation. You can see actors that have all that, Julie Roberts, Juliette Binoche, actors that have that, Jennifer Lewis, actors that have the undercurrent of emotion going on underneath. Jessica Lange is really fantastic at it. You can tell when actors are willing to really take themselves there, and you see the layers and the different colors.
Now, I know you have a new Hallmark movie, and I'm not asking you to, I don't want you to complain about anybody, but I do hear this, and I don't know a lot of actors, but, you know, 20 years ago, there wasn't really much to do other than look at your script, get to know the other actors, hang out, whatever, and kind of inhale the role. I'm guessing, I don't know. But today, with the phone, even on set, you've got people who are just totally checked out all the time, looking at other things. Did you encounter that?
No, I didn't. I didn't see people checking out. I just finished this movie the week for Hallmark. By the way, it's going to air like September 25th, I think. It's called Taking the Reins right now. So that's what it's called. I didn't see people go into their phone much. I mean, I know that people do text about the work and whatnot later. We were pretty engaged. I mean, I know what you're saying. I think people are completely addicted to their phones. And what's happening is we're losing the frontal lobe. We're losing the ability to memorize anything. And we think we're getting smarter, but we're actually not getting any smarter.
Wait a second. We're losing the frontal lobe.
Well, in my Philosophy Today magazine, it had this entire article about Plato and whatnot, what they would think about the world today. And Plato, of course, would hate social media because it's not dealing with realism or, you know, enlightenment. It's just sort of self-involved, and Socrates wouldn't like it either. It'd be more of the sophist, where they were just really more into them, what they wanted, and materialism and power. But Plato and Aristotle Socrates wouldn't have liked it. And, what this article said is that, in other words, do you remember the day we used to memorize phone numbers?
Yeah.
And the other day I was I still like to take a pencil to my math instead of just going to a calculator. So I continue to use my brain. We are turning our brains over to the machines, and we're letting the machines think for us. So we're not thinking as much as we used to. And just because we Google and may learn more information, we're not keeping it, because we don't write it. We don't ingest it, so to speak. It's sort of in and out. And it talked about the frontal lobe, and that people don't actually read books anymore, and they do some real concentrate reading of, you know, which is concentrated. And so our parts of our brains are actually diminishing, and that soon our brains will be completely integrated with the machines, because they'll be doing everything for us. And so, in a way, you know, they say Alzheimer's people need to make sure they keep their brain really working. Well, we think we're working our brain, but we're not. We're allowing the machines to work our brains, and so our brains are diminishing.
Incredible. It is. I'm glad you summarized it.
They mentioned the frontal lobe. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a doctor, but this is just what I gather. And I talk to friends who are like, if you never read a book anymore, like, yeah, I can't really focus on a book anymore. And that's why I make sure I read these long articles. And this is what I teach the kids with back to civil conversation in my foundation, which, by the way, we have a great Constitution Day workshop program that the kids teach on September 17th. But the reason I talk to these kids and want to do civic conversations, they actually have to read an article. Shocker, you know, and I teach them don't just go to clickbait or read a headline and think that that's really the news.
Yeah. No, it's gosh, we have. they're doing it all for us, big tech. They're even finding our romantic partners now. You know, there used to be a stigma meeting somebody online. You would have to come up with a cover story. You know, you met online. That was like considered weird and eccentric. Mm-hmm. Now there's safety in that. An algorithm is going to present you a bunch of choices, and that's how you meet. That's how certainly younger people meet. They rely on these apps and things like that. That's I think it's terrifying because we're surrendering. Things are atrophying our ability to sort out for ourselves and who knows what. All right, I'll stop with that. Let me ask you this, if you don't mind. A couple of things, and I want to respect your time here, that we have to address. Your sobriety. Mm-hmm. You stopped. What was your poison? What were you doing?
I was 23 years old when I stopped drinking. And I'll just say that I believe it's hereditary. It's in our family lines. And I found, you know, it's interesting. George Washington used to say, and I'm paraphrasing, that the problem with democracy is you have to feel it before you can see it. And there are a lot of people you say to make sure you don't drink, but they don't get it because they haven't felt it. And I felt the very negative sides of alcohol. And it's genetic in my entire family. I mean, you go back to my great, great grandfather and he was telling his boys, please stay away from John Barleycorn. You know, it was in the 1800s and they used to make their own, I guess, in the woods of Texas. But he was trying to teach his kids to just never pick up, never take it. And you know, I was engaged to Alec and Alec was going through his own struggles, which is for him to talk about. But through Alec, I learned about a 12-step program. I never did drugs or anything of that nature. But I just decided at the age of 20, because I started going to a 12-step program, like an Al-Anon type of thing, to be supportive with him. And that's when I discovered the 12-step program, which is why I believe God put Alec in my life. Even though, you know, the devastation of not getting married, but it was really, we both really knew it was wrong. But I learned about the 12-step program. And so then later on, I thought, you know what? I don't want to live my life this way. And I don't want to continue this pattern. And so I walked into a meeting and broke the cycle.
Do you still go to meetings?
I do. Mm-hmm. Well, not now with this COVID, but you can do them online, which are not the same. But yeah, I think meetings are awesome. And, you know, look, I'm now 35 years, so it's not like I've gone all the time and I go through phases where I go and I don't go. But I still believe the 12 steps. There's talk about God in the rooms and the 12 steps based off of it's just a wonderful, wonderful, you know, they say that what they say is what I thought was the worst thing to happen to me, which is getting sober, turned out to be the best thing to happen to me because your eyes get opened and the world becomes your oyster and the pain can be intense and you feel things more intensely. And I find that can be really hard during chapters of my life as I'm older, like with my father dying and all that. But the bottom line is I've learned how to cope and how to be a better person of character. Just things such as, you know, I turn my will and my life over the care of God. I realize I'm powerless. And then also I continue, you know, I take an inventory. When I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. And you learn not to carry resentments, all these things that really are just very applicable to staying sober because there's just so much we can carry on our shoulders and stay sober. So we have to learn to process it and learning to call and say, okay, I was wrong here. I'm going to make my amends and clean up my side of the street. And you may not want to clean up yours, but I'm going to clean up mine. And just being brave enough to kind of walk into that sort of conflict and say, I'm going to own my sins. And so it's really very, it's for survival, but it also creates a type of character. So it's, yeah, that's it.
Wow. Well, everything is better sober. I can attest to that. So real quick. The northern exposure phase. Wait, when you cut your hair, mm-hmm. When you were going through the method acting, did that that was a game changer for you, or was it not such a big deal? I mean,
I think it was a game changer. I cut my hair right before the audition, and I had long, beautiful hair. Now suddenly it was really short, and you know, once again, I was up against that stigma. And, you know, when I talk about beauty, I'm not taking any credit for it because I was just born with the way I look. And actually, I've actually fought against it all my life because there's more to me than just like what you see. But so, but what I'm going to say here, so I don't say it in any sort of vain way, but people would say, oh, look at this beautiful young woman. And now that I'm older, I look back and go, oh, I was pretty then, you know, but you and she can't possibly be smart, and she can't possibly fly an airplane, and she can't possibly, you know, kill her own. I mean, look at her. And there, so there were these stereotypical things that happened. And when I cut my hair, I think that that helped immensely when I showed up at the audition with the short hair. But when I showed up for the audition, I didn't wear jeans because I thought I looked heavy in jeans. So I wore this long skirt, and it's kind of this plaid, long, kind of unattractive skirt. And the executive producers came running out, flailing the sides, which are like, you know, 3 or 4 pages of the scene, going, why did you wear a skirt? Why did you wear a skirt? They think you're too pretty to be a pilot. And I'm like, oh my God, am I going to lose this role? Because I had $8 left in my name and all this long saga of getting there. I'm like, I've been doing this now for what, 12 years? And here was this great role. And I thought, oh my God, am I going to lose this? Because they think I'm. So I walked back in to read with Rob Morrow. I took the chair. I turned the back. And they're all looking at me, sort of. They're all staged. They're all, we're sort of low, like an old Greek stage. And they're all stair stepping up. So they're all the network and studio executives. It's very intimidating. But I go in and I take the chair and I turn it and I straddle the chair. And I just put on this persona of who I was inside, which was the strong survivor. And I ended up getting the role. So it was, but I had to fight for it. I had people to try to, people I had to see that beyond just the outside. And isn't this what we all struggle with now? Who are we inside? Don't look at the outside, look at the inside. So I relate to all the struggles that we're facing and in life, and because it doesn't matter what generation, what century, what does everybody really want? Everybody wants to be appreciated for their soul and who they are inside and not just their exterior.
Do they? I think right now there's a moment. I mean, only the last 5 seconds I'm seizing on, because now it seems to be all about what you look like. You are blessed. You are celebrated for things you can't control, your ethnicity, your gender, your orientation. Everything. I'm sorry, I went off, and please don't comment on all the stuff I just said, but I feel like, first of all, that's an amazing story. I love it, how you just owned it and you got it. But right now in America, so much is about valuing the things that, you know, are soulless.
I think that in life, things have to be shaken up and rattled. In other words, I had this teacher once that I thought, oh, it really does make sense. I don't know where it was. But things go far, far right or far, far left to kind of bring sort of attention to the issue. And then the pendulum settles back. And I think that we're just the pendulum is swinging and it settles back to that thing I talk about, which is reason and logic. But bottom line, I think, without it being a fear or a political issue, I think that's what Jesus taught. And what Jesus taught is we're in my God on the Go's. I encourage people to check out my God on the Go podcast. But Jesus, what did Jesus come to teach us? It's all about love. It's all about the inside. It's not about the money that you make or who you are. It's about loving God and loving each other. And it's about loving yourself. And I think that we want to be seen, if our souls want to be seen. And so however that's projecting itself, I think that the ethics and the logic of it all, and when you come to the center, is just the bottom line. What Jesus taught us is right, and that's what everybody wants to feel.
And
we're human beings, and like James Madison said, you know, men are not angels, and we're human beings, and it's going to get all shaken up and rattled and rolled. But the bottom principle, I believe, is that we all want to be honored inside, and we want to just be seen, and of course the give and take of that is we need to do that with other people.
And the pendulum, you're right about the pendulum. It's all going to snap back. You know, I met Patty Hearst not too long ago. Patty Hearst, remember her?
No, of course.
And you know, she's a normal woman living in New York. She's not a radical. She's not crazy. She's just somebody you meet at a party. We don't have, you know, they were robbing banks and kidnapping people in 1970, like all the time. There were plane hijackings, like 3 or 4 a month. So we think right now is horrible. We've been there, and it's actually arguably much worse. So if you don't mind, when you're on Northern Exposure, and this is something, this is back to my rudimentary questions about acting, mm-hmm. you actually film totally out of sequence, right? An episode mm-hmm. is done. It's not from beginning to end, like the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Is that hard? To the viewer, it's like the idea that you guys do it that way is like vaguely disappointing. You know what I mean? Like, oh my gosh. But that's got
to
be...
And now that I'm going into theater, you know, we're going to be rehearsing from the beginning to the end, and it's going to be very organic, and you're out there doing, you're presenting from beginning to end, and it's in front of a live audience, and that's going to have its own genre of difficulty. But film and television is very, very hard. And what I think is what's weird is that you're like this movie I just finished for Hallmark, Taking the Reins, I think is what they're going to call it. We're all thrown in to a group. And I was there for 2 out of 3 weeks, and suddenly I have a husband, and I have a daughter, and I have all. And you have to sort of go into this pretend world, and then you shoot everything out of order. Though actually, we did shoot the last scene last, which never happens. But last time, the last scene is first. But you're thrown into this weird sort of psychological twist, where suddenly you have to pretend to be someone. And then this wasn't a really difficult role for me. It's a really great little movie of the week, but it wasn't a difficult role for me. But if it's difficult, you know, you psychologically pull yourself into this. You might be having a great day and you have to go in and do a tragic scene, or you might have a tragedy going on in your life and you have to go in and shoot a really happy scene. And so you have to organically shake everything of your own life off and go imbue this character. And you have, and there's, so there's this weird sort of intensity of passions that happen, and then boom, you wrap, you're like, bye everybody. And it's just the weirdest psychological thing. I mean you get home and for a few days you're just sort of decompressing because it's just such a weird mind game. The difficulty about film is that, you know, hair and makeup and people are talking, they're doing their thing, and everyone's the whole crew of 100 people, and you're in this squished place, whether it's a set or a studio or not a studio, you're all squished. And then suddenly they say action, and you got to have it right then and there. I mean, I played Anthony Hopkins' wife in this movie called Solace. And I only had one scene, and it was the very last scene. But when they said Anthony Hopkins, I'm like, I'm there. And I had in 5 lines, I had to bring up everything that we'd gone through our lives and the loss of a child and all this, and 5 lines, last scene of the movie. And so in rehearsal, I walked in and there was, you know, Anthony Hopkins and I had met the day before. He's just this nicest, most wonderful person on the planet, world's greatest actor. And he's sitting there, and now he's on this bench and he's in a different character, and I'm rehearsing. And I started to cry. And then he stood and was, oh my God, that's so good. That's so good. Don't rehearse her anymore. You know, I don't think she knows how good she is. Oh my God. Okay. Let her go. So I'm like, oh my God, now I've got to deliver it just that way. Because instead of just organically letting whatever happen, which is you either cry, you don't cry. I was like, now it's like, I knew what I needed to deliver to him is what he wanted. And I wanted to please Anthony Hopkins. And so, but now I got to go back to the trailer. I got to go into hair and makeup. I have to sit and wait. And then I walk out. My very first scene and my only scene with Anthony Hopkins where he wants me to cry now is because he loved it so much, or at least he liked it and I wanted to give that to him. I have people shaking my hands, welcome to the show. And they're pulling my, you know, brushing my hair, and there's a spider in my hair and it's hot. And my very first scene is a close-up, my very first thing. And then everyone's like all over me. And then it's like action. I'm like, oh my God. And so that's what's so hard. I mean, watch an actor the next time you see that and understand the organics that are going behind. And then if you say, can I just have a minute to try to get in to get into character? They go, sure. And then the whole crew of 100 have their elbows on their knees and their hands in their chins watching you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we're waiting for you to cry now, and it's very expensive. And so now the whole world is watching you, and the set's completely quiet. Now you really can't concentrate. It's just this craziness. But when you watch another actor and they're crying and doing this amazing scene, watch and see how many different angles. Is there a wide shot of it? Is there a close-up of it? Is there a cowboy, which is at the hips of it? And realize that actor had to reproduce that 3 or 4 different times over the course of 1 or 2 days. I mean, it's just – it's a crazy world. It's very difficult.
So, two more quick things on this. Is it annoying that everybody, civilians, outsiders, or even friends and family, when you're an actor, when you're a successful actor like yourself, people always think they have a sense of your career, or they'll say something like, They always seem to say the wrong thing to people who are performers. What am I trying to say? Like, oh, I haven't seen you on TV in a while, or I really, you know, and or wait a second. They act kind of funny around people who are prominent. I don't know. I just feel like actors in particular, though, like they sometimes don't feel ownership of certain things. Like, I really like that movie, or I really like, they'll always say the same thing. They'll always say the wrong thing. Does that make sense? Do fans sometimes say the wrong thing? For instance, I was at the Fox News Channel, and somebody would come up to me, this is a long time ago, like, oh, you're Greg Kelly, right? Oh, that's fantastic. Wow. Hey, I got to tell you something. Yeah, I really like Bill O'Reilly. And like they, I've noticed that, I've noticed that with actors. I feel like people are always saying the wrong things to them.
Yeah, you know, where I've run into that is as an author, right? It's funny because as an author, because I've published 4 books, and as an author, you just hope people read the book, you know, and that people would buy it and enjoy the book. And I have had some people that come up to me after they've read the book and say, oh, you know, I really liked it, and da-da-da. I'm like, oh, thank you. But it's pretty funny, always with your family. I have people come up, I won't say who in my family, but they'll say, I read your book. And I'm like, great.
And they would say,
silence. Yeah. And I'm like, uh-huh. And they're like, yeah, I read it. Okay, bye. I'm like, wait, what? And so I was like, you read it? You don't have any comment? I mean, tell me even something you didn't like, but it's just like, I read it. Yeah, it just crickets. And I hope that I still think my books have been very interesting. And so, but it's just with books, I find it's really pretty fascinating because most people don't, as we talked about the frontal lobe, most people don't actually really read a book anymore. But from an acting standpoint, I look, before Northern Exposure, I had $8 left in my name. And at the height of Northern Exposure, which of course was only about 3 or 4 networks, it was sort of a countrywide phenomenon that people did at the same time. Mm-hmm. You had to wait and watch it on Mondays or, you know, at 9 o'clock. And so the country did it together. That's why they talked about it on the radio and at the water cooler. And it was this thing because it was sort of a sense of community, which we don't even have that anymore. Everybody's streaming things at random times. There's no sense of community, even with watching television. But people would come in. I couldn't walk into a restaurant where 5 people wouldn't just come sit down at the table with me. And people would say, doesn't this get crazy? And I'd say, well, no, it's better than being broke and unemployed. And once the thing I've learned from 12-step is make gratitude your attitude. And I was just always so grateful that hey, I had a job that people loved. And it was a character that I loved. Now I'm at this point in my career where I'm writing this play and I just pray to God it's a success and it works and relaunches me, because I could have been nominated for Emmys and Golden Globes and had a great career, but no one cares now.
No one cares now.
Starting all over it. No, starting all over in the industry. I'm right back to square one. Hoping I can get an audition, hoping someone will see me, hoping that, you know, it's crazy. It's not as glamorous and people aren't really built. So actually when I hear someone say whether it's really correct or not, if they just enjoy my work, it's just always nice to hear it because you just don't hear it. And like, I guess in a play, you're going to hear instant gratification. But when you're on a set, you're in this dark set, everybody's neurotic and into their own thing. You do this amazing work, you think, or you deliver what you hope to deliver as an artist, and everyone's like, okay, wrap, go home.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, maybe that's what breeds the neurosis in actors.
Is there, look, there is a sense.
It's not as glamorous as you think.
Is there a sense, do you think that, okay, wait a second, Jeanine Turner, she's in those movies, she was Northern Exposure, she's set for life. Is there a sense of that, like even like, you know, among?
I think there is. I gave a speech once about a single motherhood and how difficult it is and the things I've gone through. And of course, you know, I was giving up. We didn't make the money they make now in Northern Exposure. And I was pretty essentially giving up my career to raise my daughter. And I was really worried about finances and how I was going to do it alone. And they say, well, she did seem to sort of understand what we're going through, as if I can't understand what normal people go through as a single mom, you know? I forget your question, but yeah.
No. I guess, yeah. You answered it. Like people think from the outside, oh, she's set for life.
And yeah. No. It's not like that at all. Yeah. It's not like that at all. It's a grind. You constantly have to prove yourself, and I think that's probably for everybody. But you know, back to you know, Instagram and how dangerous it is when someone has a million followers and you're hoping for 4 more and all this. And I go and I look at my contemporaries who have had all this work done to their face, and I haven't done any, And I, you know, I look at my, it's kind of really, oh God, it's going to be so hard to watch this movie the week to see how old I'm going to look. But I have this idea that I'm not brave enough to do it yet, right? I watched one of my contemporaries, I won't say who, take a snapshot of herself in the mirror looking perfect. You know, she's my age, perfect hair, perfect body, but it's not perfect by nature. It's perfect by surgery. Perfect, perfect, perfect. And it's like, oh, look at me. I'm getting ready to go do this or that. And this is this culture that we have now. And I thought, and I took a picture of myself, you know, in a ratty nightgown, my hair like all up in a, like frizzing out everywhere, wrinkles on my face. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to snap this into hashtag it rally for real? I mean, wouldn't it be cool to really rally about what's real? Because we put on this pretend thing out there on social media, whether it's pretend news, pretend politics, pretend problems, pretend happiness, pretend it's Plato would hate it to come full circle. There's nothing real about it. But wouldn't it be funny to do rally for real? I'm not quite there yet, but
it's
you know.
that has big potential. I like it. Are you friendly still with Rob Morrow?
We've seen each other. Yeah, you know, I think that we'll always have a special place in our hearts for each other, because it was just this, we were, speak about being together, we were all on location together in Seattle. We lived there together for 5 years, and we worked 14 hours a day for 5 years. And it was a very, very special time in all of our lives. So anytime we all get on for some kind of reunion, there's just a warm glow.
And Constituting America, when did you start that?
Well, I launched Constituting America in 2010, and ironically, people think my legacy will be Northern Exposure, and I hope my Broadway show will be a legacy. But I really think my legacy is Constituting America, and I'm so proud of it. And it just does. It's really been difficult for me, because I have to realize, what I've realized as I go into be sort of a CEO of this foundation, is how I've been trained to be emotional. Think about it. You're trained to be emotional. You're trained to go out there and bear your emotions on stage or in front of the camera. That's what you're trained to do. Like, you're trained to be a pilot, you're trained to be a computer tech, whatever you're trained to do. We're trained to be emotional. And so you go into this world of a CEO. And of course, I have this intellectual side, so it's fine. I'm able to kind of make the sort of jump, but not that actors aren't intellectual, but you know what I mean? It's kind of a different CEO type of world. It's been really, really fascinating for me to go into this, because I have this business aspect of it as well. And, but I love what I do. I've given over 600 speeches, over 560 something to students alone, where I before COVID would walk into these classrooms, many of them Title I schools, and I try to just give these kids hope. And I try to teach the nonpartisan aspect of the United States Constitution, why it matters. Because what I think happens is, you know, people are saying it's passé now, and there's this movement, and it's actually prevents tyranny, and the checks and balances protect those Bill of Rights. But also, I feel that it's being taught in schools, if it's taught at all, in ways where this is what they do in Washington, and this is what they do in maybe your state. But so it's taken out of the application aspect of the student's mind. And so they kind of half zone out, half listen, half care. And they don't understand. They don't feel it yet to know it yet. Like George Washington said about why, what their part's going to be in this republic that we have. And so what I try to teach the kids is I try to give them a way to apply it to their own lives. So I'll go into these classrooms and I'll say, this is our George Washington Speaking Initiative. We have many platforms with the foundation, but I will go in and say, all right. And I teach the some of the principles of the Constitution. It's a 10 quiz sort of layout template. But what I'll say is, I want you to think about something that you want to change in your neighborhood or in your country. What do you want to change? And I'm going to come back to this, so be thinking about it. So then when I get to the First Amendment, I teach them, you know, RAPs or whatever, but an element of that is I said, we're going to use the First Amendment now to exclude religion, and we're going to figure out how to make a change with that thing that bothers you. And so I'll have them raise their hand. I say, what bothers you? And kids will say, too many potholes, or it's too dark in my neighborhood, or we want a key to the community pool, or there are too many drugs in my neighborhood, I'm worried for my sister, or you know, someone else might say, we want to be able to drill a well in our backyard, or we want more perks for small businesses. Or they might even say, you know, no immigration laws, whatever. It's not for me to judge, because it's, the Constitution's nonpartisan. whatever they say to me, I say, all right, this is how you can make that happen. This is why the Constitution's important. And I talk about the checks and balances, of course, but I have them write a petition and say, how can you use these First Amendment rights? And I said, the first thing any what everybody wants to do is run out and protest. But if you don't have a logical sense, since we're a nation of laws, about what you want to accomplish, your protest is not going to be really that effective. Yes, you have that right, but how do we build up to that? So I teach them to say, okay, less potholes. How can we go about writing a petition? How would you solve this problem? And I talked about how to solve it. It's fascinating what they come up with, you know, how to raise the money. Sometimes it doesn't have to do with government at all. How they can fix these potholes.
Sorry, but are these kids? Who?
They're middle school kids and high school kids.
Where?
All over the country.
And how do they seek you out? How would you, what are you providing that the schools?
We're giving them, sometimes we do it over the internet, right? But we just come in a fun and unique different way and teach about the Constitution. So it's usually to history classes, though we have a contest as well, where we have kids create short films and best songs and best public service announcements and best STEM. So we can go into the science classrooms or the artistic classrooms, any type of classroom in regard to the contest and how to apply it. But no, most of the time I'm in their history classes or their government classes. And I teach them, what would you do first? How to write that petition and then to use their speech. And then to use their press, and then to go out and have their assembly, and then to call their congressman, and to take their idea to their congressman. So it's just real. But now what they're thinking, oh, the Constitution. Oh, it really does mean something to me in my life. I can't apply it to my life, and this is why my First Amendment rights matter. And we're not just giving kids a bunch of chatter. Or here's a worksheet, and this is what they do in Washington, yeah. And how they're responsible for what happens in Washington, and they can elect them and fire them and hire them, and it's their money that pays for them. And it's just really fantastic, because what I say to these kids is, I want you to feel empowered by the time you leave this room, and I want you to understand how the Constitution helps you do that.
So
they grow up with a working knowledge of why it matters.
Are you anticipating, or have you yet received some pushback about just how nonpartisan the Constitution is or isn't? I believe it's nonpartisan. I believe it's beautiful. I believe it's the greatest document in the modern world. But you know, there are now mainstream people saying that the fundamental underpinnings are racist. That two senators per state, that was a great compromise. But no, now it's seen as a vestige of racism and slavery. And this was to appease slave owners and all that stuff. I mean, this is now taken on mainstream status, that fundamentally this is a racist country, and the Constitution reflects that. Which, by the way, I don't agree with, but I don't think, obviously, you haven't encountered that yet, but you will. You realize foundation can get more complicated.
We've had a hard time getting into certain schools, most definitely, that don't. And also we have to be a trusted entity. If they think that we're going to go in and rattle off a bunch of political jargon, we'll never be trusted and we'll never be allowed in the classroom. And that's not even respectful. That's not even true to the Constitution, because the no party system even existed when the Constitution was written. And the Constitution is for all Americans. It's not just for any party. And so we go in, and I specifically stay away from politics because I want to honor what I believe the Constitution honors. But we do get pushback. We do have people that don't want us to come in. And there are a lot of teachers that do want us to come in. And I consider it like a ripple effect. They trust us. They trust us that we could go in these schools, and we go into a lot of these Title I schools, and the kids then understand. And it's great when I hear feedback, because kids will be dealing with something in their classroom where they're debating whether to have phones in their classroom, and it'll be 2 or 3 days later, and they'll say, well, Ms. Turner taught us to write a petition, so let's write a petition, you know, and the kids learn that that's embedded in the Constitution. So I know that, look, I'm just trying to go in and present what's ethical and logical, and that is that the Constitution is going to protect all these rights that we want. But as what Scalia said, the Bill of Rights has unique things to it that the Magna Carta did not have. But the Bill of Rights were not aren't necessarily unique. What's unique is the checks and balances that prevents a tyrant. And I talk about them that a lot with them. And you know, I tell you what, I never talk politics on a set ever. And somehow it slipped that I was dealing with Constituting America on one set, and that opened a whole can of worms. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my God, I don't want to get into this. 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 And, but the, one of the things I said is, you know, it's really interesting because when a Republican's in office, Democrats love the Constitution. And, you know, when so it's, we all love it when we need it because we all believe that it prevents tyranny. And, it's just a document, especially the amendment process. Now that's one of those things that's going to take a lot of frontal lobe, and it's going to take a lot of time to actually make an amendment happen. And I don't know, we can't lose sight of how important that is. And people probably don't really have the patience. So things are just done with laws, you know, all that. Don't get me started. There's so many things we can talk about.
By the way, what does it takes a hell of a lot. It's 2/3 of the Congress and 2/3 of the states or something. What is it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, 2/3 of both houses and then 2/3 of the state. No, it's 2/3 and 3/4.
3/4 of the states.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's 2/3 in the Congress and 3/4 in the states. And so it takes time, but that's good, right? That it means it has to be methodical and people have to think it through and the states get their say. And it's a wonderful process. But now no one wants to take the time because they want instant gratification. But we also do things about this wonderful contest, and we're getting ready to take all the kids to Washington, D.C. who won the contest. Here's what we do that nobody else does. We promote their works. We don't hire an ad company. So their PSAs, their songs, their short films, we actually hire companies. Their essays get into, say, the Washington Times and things of that nature. But we hire a company to promote their public service announcements. It could be a sophomore in high school. And they've been on millions and millions, and it's appeared in millions of households. We have incredible impact numbers, but it's the kids' works. And they're like, Mom, look, my PSA's on TV. Hmm. And what are they doing? They're just talking about the Constitution in a nonpartisan way to get – because if we can't infiltrate the culture – forget schools. If you can't infiltrate the culture, you can't win. And then we have these songs where we have amazing songs, these kids, albums we have now after 10 years of these kids. And we hire a company out of Nashville who gets their songs. We re-record them. We do a lot of times we do music videos with them. But we get their songs on the radio, millions of plays on the radio of people singing about the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or religious freedom on the radio, millions and millions and millions of plays. So we actually promote these kids' works, which is a wonderful opportunity for them. And then we're taking them on this trip where they get to go to the Supreme Court. Last trip in 2019, they met with Chief Justice John Roberts, who came out and spoke with him for 45 minutes.
So cool. Wow.
And private tours of the White House and all of these things. So it's that we have a 90-day study where we study.
So you met him too, right?
Yeah. We got a picture taken with him. And so
don't get me started on that guy, by the way.
It's just wonderful that they get to meet a Supreme Court justice.
It's so amazing.
And they get to see a face behind the politics or the what people think. And it's always different. It's just like not being in social media when you can actually sit there and look at somebody and learn about their lives, right, and how they got to be to where they are. But thanks to Kathy Gillespie for a lot of this, right? They know everybody, Kathy Gillespie and but it's a wonderful organization. We have 90-day studies. And so I'm very, very proud of – oh, I do want to give a plug that on Constitution Day, if you want something to do with your kids or you have a school and a classroom, we have workshops from 10:45 to 3:45 where these kids are – we're going to read through the entire Constitution live. And then these kids are breaking out in workshops where they talk about how they wrote a song and you learned about the Constitution and wrote a song about the Constitution and learned about the Constitution, wrote an essay or a stint or created an app or created a short film or a public service announcement. And so these kids are going to be teaching kids. I'll be there asking them questions. But it's great because we incorporate the Constitution with the culture, and we teach it. And that's going to be on September 17th. And they go to constitutingamerica.org or American Thing, because it's an American thing, americanthing.org. They can sign up.
I will be sure to emphasize that on the website as well. Why did you pick that, though? I mean, you're obviously interested in a lot of different things. This is a very specific thing, specific project. 2010, I think you said you started 2011. Like
2010, yeah.
2010. Just because I guess you're just your overall your childhood, everything, it all just came together.
Yeah, I think you could say that. Someone was asking me that the other day and really pressing me on it, and I was like, gosh, you know, it was 11 years ago. I think that a couple of reasons. One is I'm related to George Washington and through his grandfather, and I just suppose, so I'm told. And I have all this love. I think I have a guardian angel that's a founding father. My dad was in the Air Force, but also it was a West Pointer. But I also believe that my educator, my fifth grade teacher, implanted a great love of the founding fathers. It was a new school, the country school in Fort Worth. Cows were literally in the playground. Loved this school. And Mr. Ingram was my fifth grade teacher. And to teach us about the Constitution and the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence, we rehearsed all year the play, which everyone should run, not walk, to see the musical. It's a movie now, the musical 1776 about the Declaration of Independence. And I played Martha Washington, and that just planted the seed and it created my love of John Adams and my love of the founding fathers that never went away. And that's the importance of education. And really, that's what I'm trying to echo is what Mr. Ingram did for me in fifth grade. And I combine the arts, but not in every, because we include STEM too, but I combine the arts with the Constitution. And it just had a pivotal impact on me. And it was 2010, and I'd read a few books that inspired me. And I just thought, you know, the Constitution. So I don't know. It was just this sort of, I guess it was just this light bulb that went off of an inspiration from God, something to do. It was something I could do for the country to give back and to teach rising generations about why the Constitution matters in ways that perhaps they're not learning about it in schools today. And then to do it in a way with schools, but also in a way that affects the culture.
I love it. I love it. So, Janine.
Wait, we have to talk about God on the Go.
Forgive me. Yes, of course. And actually before...
To close here, I want to talk just a moment about God on the Go.
God on the Go. Well, are you a born-again Christian?
No, I'm not a born-again Christian. I think I know there are born-again Christians that just have this pivotal light go off. I think my life, Dustin Hoffman once said that his career was a series of breaks. And I think for me, my faith has been a series of enlightenments, a series of light bulbs, a series of course, sort of born-agains where I reach a higher and higher level. I guess like a jet propulsion, a rocket ship, you know, you know, this part of the launch and then this part and then this part and this part. I think that I just have had an innate, my great grandmother was a pillar of the Baptist church and my dad was Episcopalian. So my parents actually fought over church and which one was the right one to go to. So often I was watching other people go to church on Sunday, but I was still raised with, you know, Christian values and faith in the church. And I was baptized in the Baptist church when I was 13, 14. And so it's really been innate. And yeah, that's the answer to that question. Yeah.
And all right, so you're a Christian.
But I'm not Baptist now. I'm Methodist if we had to pick up. But I've been all of them. I've been Presbyterian, Baptist, Bible. But I really have settled on Methodist. And my grandfather, on my grandfather's side, my great-grandfather was a Methodist preacher.
And being a Christian to you is means what?
Wow, that's very broad. Trying to do the best with my life that within the talents that God has given me to honor God and do His will with my life. And I tell you what, I feel like I fail at that more than I succeed. And it's not always a bright, happy, shining light. I go through a lot of kind of deep holes of situational depression, but God is always there to take my hand and pull me out of it. So faith is two-way street. I think faith is how I honor and live a life that God wants me to live of love and self-awareness. And but then it's God be there for me when I fail.
And so you have crammed this into a podcast. These are very short, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
God on the Go. Tell us about it.
Well, they used to be a minute. Well, you know, I read meditations and especially after my daughter was born in 1997, my faith took on an entirely new level, and I realized I was going to be alone without her father, and what I was having to deal with on that end. And in regard to her father and everything, it was not what I had planned. It's not how I would have, you know, perceived my, you know, I joke about single motherhood. Single mothers don't go, oh yeah, you know, someday I want to grow up and have five children, get a divorce and raise the children by myself. Or someday I want to grow up and have a child and the father won't be around. It's just really not what 99.9% of women want. Mm-hmm. But I found myself in this situation. And so my faith took an even deeper level then. And reading the Bible through and through and Bible study. And I would read it with my daughter every day. And I would pray over my daughter every day on the way to school. And we'd read the Bible together. It was just a pivotal part of our lives. And I think that's the Baptist in me, right? The Bible reading and a Protestant. Not that Catholics don't, because Catholics do read the Bible, but in my particular upbringing, the Bible was a forefront through those venues of types of denominations. And I don't know. I wrestled. The one I just did, I talk about the fact that often I feel I'm not even worthy to do these God on the goes. But I was giving a speech somewhere in middle America, and someone said, you know, you ought to do these little 1 minute things and you could put them on the radio and all of that. And I thought, oh, well, okay, I guess I could do that with my daily meditation of sorts. So I was cramming them into a minute. And I would just take the Bible verse I read that day and my life experiences and just apply it to my life today and how to make it work in a minute. Now they're more like seven after 2020, the COVID, I started make it a little more of a podcasty feel. So there are 7 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 11 minutes, and they're a little bit longer, but I just try to sort of whatever I'm walking through, whatever I'm going through, applying scripture or whatever motivation I may have at that moment. And then I put them out there on social media.
And, did anybody ever hold this against you throughout your career?
Well, most people, you have to realize I haven't been doing that much in my career. There's so many podcasts out there today that unless, you know, all you have to do is go to my website and you'll see God on the Go, you'll see Constituting America, and people can probably see that I, you know, have a certain leaning in my political, and that does get in the way. It gets in the way big time with Hollywood, just big time. What can I do? I'm not going to change who I am and what I believe. I'm certainly not going to give up my faith for Hollywood. And, but you know, there are a lot of faithful people and there are a lot of in Hollywood and there are a lot of people in Hollywood that do lean in at least the middle. I consider myself now probably an independent. I want to be a free thinker. But if you're a conservative in the industry, you absolutely cannot speak. Cannot.
That's so wrong.
But I just do what I do, and I do the God on the Go, and people, you know, it's I get a lot of responses back that it helps people and helps inspire them and lifts them out of their lives' difficulties. And so I thought, well, you know, God, and I pray, I say, okay, God, let me say what you want me to say. And that's the way I write, too, when I write. I really feel it's really not this God working through me. And I think God's working through me on the God of the Goes. And it's just something that I took a little break for a couple of months because I think also in my Broadway play, there's going to be a lot of inspiration in that. And God can guide us in different ways to have an impact in different ways. But I'm back to doing them once a day. I was doing them every day. Now I'm doing them once or twice a week.
Well, I'm so glad you are. And I'm so glad, you know, usually at the end of a conversation, I'll ask somebody, you know, almost sheepishly on my part about their faith, because I do like to know about it. And I liked, mm-hmm. and they have interesting answers, but it's been relegated, to, you know, by me and by others to, you know, a coda as opposed to, something much more important and central. I've gotten more comfortable talking about it myself, but, it's so important what
you're
doing.
Well, how sad that we can't talk about faith anymore, right? We ought to be able to talk about our faith.
Yeah. And speaking of the Bible, I mean, he doesn't like lukewarm believers. I should update that. I am.
It's the basic tenet of, you know, religious freedom is a basic tenet of our country, and we ought to be able to talk about our faith. But and be open to other people's faith. I think that's a part of the country, you know, that's how we believe as a country is that, and it's very much in the 12-step program. You don't have to be a certain faith, but I have a certain faith and I ought to be able to speak my faith.
Well, many thanks to Janine Turner. Go to constitutingamerica.org for more information about that really cool group. And God on the Go, podcast is really, really something. And we'll be looking for that Hallmark movie and maybe some reruns of Northern Exposure. And I also recommend the Cliffhanger movie that she starred in with Sylvester Stallone. And I really liked her. I think she might just be a new friend, as I said. So, in the meantime, next time we talk, it will be solo. I will not have a guest. We're transitioning to another type of podcast. It's not just going to be me solo, but a few of the episodes will be me solo. So if you have a question, if there's anything you'd like to run by me, go to our website, which is, what is our website? GregKellyPodcast.com. GregKellyPodcast.com. You can leave a question there and or an observation, but better yet, a question, because I'm going to build an episode around your questions. And Maya Zumwalt will collect those questions and put them all together, and she'll forward me the appropriate questions and maybe hopefully a couple of inappropriate questions as well. And, well, it's an experiment. I think it's worth it. So thanks so much for listening and all the support. And let's hope and pray that everything works out for those stuck in Afghanistan. Many, many thanks, and take care.